Leave the Sri Lankan government's breaking a pledge not to fire artillery into the tiny strip of coastland where the Tamil Tigers are surrounded, along with thousands of Tamil civilians who they've been using as human shields. Philip Reeves, NPR News.
According to a report from the Rockefeller Institute of Government, tax collections continued to drop in almost every state during the first quarter of 2009. That's down an average 13% from a year earlier as the recession and wary customers cut into income and sales tax revenue. The report also shows a nearly 16% average decline in personal income taxes, the steepest drop since 2002. An institute analysis says that tax revenue is expected to decline further in the quarter ending in June, and that will include April income tax returns hit hard by financial market declines in 2008. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, during National Foster Care Month, promoting lifelong family connections for all kids in foster care at aecf.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Come sort through the thousands of CDs, DVDs, tapes, and albums, plus stereo equipment for sale at Vintage Vinyl this Saturday at Lincoln Square, Urbana. Proceeds benefit Illinois Radio Reader. For sale hours and other information, visit our website at will.illinois.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. It was reported last month that cyber spies from outside of the United States had penetrated the country's electricity grid. Their goal apparently was not to do damage, but to gather information. Yet, even so, that incident raised a lot of questions about the security of our electrical system. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk a bit about cybersecurity and the electrical grid. And we have three guests, all of them here from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. George Gross is a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, also in the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And he's been on this program before to talk about things like regulation and deregulation in the electric industry. Also to talk a little bit about the robustness of the electricity transmission system that we have here in this country. Our other guests are William Sanders and Himanshu Khurana. William Sanders is professor of engineering here at the U of I. He's also director of the Information Trust Institute. And Professor Khurana, he is a research assistant professor in the computer science department and is also involved in the Information Trust Institute. And we're pleased they could be here on the show and talk with us. And questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if people want to get involved in the conversation, they certainly may do that. Well, the only thing we ask of people who call is that they just try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can keep moving along. But anyone is welcome to call here and again in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here. We appreciate it. As a way, just before we kind of get into the subject, I would like to maybe I'll ask William Sanders to talk a little bit about the Information Trust Institute and what it is that you all are interested in there.
Sure. The Information Trust Institute is a department within the College of Engineering. We have academic departments, which is obvious, but we also have research departments. And ITI was formed about 5 years ago based on the perception and reality that many of the infrastructures we depend on, the power grid, but avionics, banking, all sorts of different industries must be trustworthy. And simply said, trust is the property that the populace, the humans, can depend on a system to do what it's supposed to do and nothing else. Yeah. There's 105 faculty that are now a member of the Institute from 21 different departments. It's primarily based in engineering, but we have faculty members from psychology, from business, from law. Basically, because trust it transcends technology and the human issues. Yeah.
And also there's something I know that both you and Professor Khurana are involved in that also involves people from other universities, and that is the Trustworthy Cyber Infrastructure for the Power Grid Project.
Exactly.
Of which you, Professor Sanders, you're the director, and Professor Khurana, you are the principal research scientist. You want to talk a little bit about what that project is about?
Sure. TCIP is a research center that's housed at the Information Trust Institute that Bill just talked about. It's a National Science Foundation-funded research center, but also has support from the Department of Energy and the Department of Homeland Security. There are four partner institutions involved. University of Illinois is the lead institution, but we also have Washington State University, Cornell University, and Dartmouth College. And together, we're looking at cybersecurity for the power grid, in particular looking at how to make the cyber infrastructure that's emerging to be trustworthy and effective at what it does. Mm-hmm. We're looking at cyber attacks, but also looking at how to continue to meet the real-time availability needs of this large and important critical infrastructure that we have.
Yeah. Maybe let me turn to Professor Gross, because I think probably the last time that we spoke was, and I think it maybe has been a couple of years, when we were talking about concerns about the infrastructure of the power system. But this was more, in a sense, it was more the mechanical infrastructure, the towers, the wires, those sorts of things. And I think people will remember, I don't know, you can prompt me how many years ago this was, we had a major power failure in the northeastern part of the United States.
So that was 2003.
2003. So that's been, that has been 6 years. And I know that people in your field, people like you, have been concerned about the strength, the robustness of the system for a long time. And it takes something like this recent story for your average person to even start thinking about it. But given the fact that, you know, that was that big event that happened 6 years ago, is the system any stronger? Are we better? Have we done much in these 6 years to address the weaknesses in the system, do you think?
Well, yes, of course. We have addressed many of the weaknesses that became apparent. But are we done? No, we're not done, because we're still working on the whole notion of situational awareness, which was one of the big issues that nobody knew the situation. So in this project that you discussed with Himanshu and with Bill, we're involved with the smart grid aspects. And one of the objectives of the smart grid is to improve the reliability of the system. So we're not completely done, but the set of factors which caused that 2003 blackout, that could never be repeated again, and if it would, we would know how to counteract that, so we would not have the set of outcomes that that we did. But it's a very daunting challenge, and it's not something that we can solve in 6 years or even another 10 years, because we constantly have to improve it. And I think in terms of what we're doing right now, we're addressing some of the very basic problems, because, as you very well stated, the electricity infrastructure is really fundamental to all the other infrastructures. We cannot get water because it depends on electric pumping. Mm-hmm. We cannot get transportation. The banking is going to cease. The computers won't work with electricity. So it's by far the most fundamental. And the work that we're doing here is really critical to the well-being of the nation, and actually of any nation, not only our nation. Yeah.
So, David, maybe I'll just add that one of the things we learned, which I think is very important, is that that one can't distinguish this, if you will, physical infrastructure of the power flowing through the lines, sometimes what we call the big grid, and the IT infrastructure, the small grid in which the bits and bytes are flowing through. What we learned in 2003 was that those two networks are linked very closely together, and that we need to understand the relationship between them. And in fact, that was the whole impetus for TCIP. Computer scientists and engineers like Himanshu and I and myself are involved in that. But it was only possible to happen here, which has now become, if you will, the national academic resource for research in this area, because we had a very small or a very, 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 very strong power group, people like George Gross and his colleagues, Pete Sauer and Tom Overby and others. And by bringing together people from the classical power side, and we've maintained a very strong program here, and people from the CS side, we've been able to build something that's really unique. And in fact, it's a new blend of people, the people that are graduating, the people that are going to invent, if you will, this new power grid of the future need to be people that are of this merged discipline. Yeah. So I think that's a very fundamental thing that we learned and is very important.
Well, it certainly strikes me, and here I'm underlining a point that you both have already made, but how important the internet and that as a way of mediating this other system has become. I think that, you know, for example, if you were thinking about, okay, you'd like to do something that would cause a great deal of chaos and disruption in the United States, if you took out the electrical power, that certainly would do it. And then he started thinking, well, okay, how would you do that? And maybe the first thing people would think of, well, let's go out and blow up some towers and take down some wires, take down the physical infrastructure, and that could certainly cause a lot of problems. But I think now what we're coming to appreciate, something I'm sure you knew a long time ago, but what people are coming to appreciate is the fact that you don't need to go and you don't need to blow up the towers to have that to happen, that it is possible in a completely different way from – and maybe from a long way away to cause that disruption in the system if you can get into this – the kind of command and control network that exists in cyberspace, and that you could do this that kind of damage. Maybe you could do even more damage than if you went on and you took down a couple of towers. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, to give an example, and I think you said it very well, there was someone who was convicted in Wisconsin a few years ago. The name was Dr. Chaos, if you want to go on the internet and look, and convicted of basically going out and taking with friends big rolls of barbed wire and throwing them over the fences of the substation, causing things to short out, causing local disturbances. You can imagine that in order to cause a coordinated attack, the one like we heard about in 2003, that would have to be done relatively simultaneously in many places. Well, the challenge and the if you will, the risk of cyber is that there could be a single location where potentially these kinds of things could be done in many locations under program control. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we in the TSIP Center look at, how to build a combined cyber and physical infrastructure where those things can't happen.
So we can think of the power system as being probably the most vulnerable system, because in the open, we can't bury all those lines. We can't bury the power stations. It would be far too expensive. People would not pay for the electricity coming out from those kind of facilities. It would be extremely expensive, and electricity is really a basic service without which we cannot survive. This is the unseen part of the power system, which is equally vulnerable, and that's what we're trying to protect.
Let me just very quickly introduce everyone once again. Here our guests include George Gross. He's professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, also is professor in the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Also with us, William Sanders. He's professor of engineering and also director of the Information Trust Institute. Himanshu Khurana, he is a research assistant professor in the Computer Science Department and is also a principal research scientist with the Information Trust Institute. And we're talking about cybersecurity and the nation's electricity grid. Questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just real quick here, and I've got a caller I will get to. I promise I'm not going to wait and make this person wait. But just can we review this event that took place in April? Well, I don't know if it's not correct to say the event took place in April. The story broke in April. This kind of thing, no doubt, has been going on for some time. This was when I think it first came up in people's awareness. Essentially, what is the story here, and how worrisome is something like this?
So the story and our knowledge here in TSIP is basically what you and the readers might have seen in the Wall Street Journal, of an article where the Department of National Intelligence sources have said that there exists some evidence of malware being left behind by nation states that are interested in potentially harming the infrastructure or otherwise having the ability to do so in a time of war. And so what that to try and explain what that might be, just around the same time, there was another story that came out about the Conflicker worm that people may have heard about, where it was another Windows-based virus that was spreading the internet infrastructure. Mm-hmm. That's just an example of a malware that might potentially be out there. Now, over here, we do not have access to classified information, so we can neither, you know, we cannot vouch for the, we cannot verify the statement, but we are very interested in figuring out what such, how such malware can be installed. If so, are there command control operations that are in place to use it when needed? And what kind of protective measures should be in place to prevent from such malware being exploited at some point in time?
Mm-hmm. So literally what happened was that it seemed that people who were not necessarily but potentially hostile to the United States, that you could imagine we might be involved in conflict with, had in a stealthy, although it had been discovered in a stealthy manner, were in a sense creeping around in cyberspace in the network that is involved in controlling the grid, and just kind of looking around, seeing how everything was set up, looking in a figurative sense where all the wires ran, identifying particular places where if damage was done, it would cause a lot of trouble. And then, as I understand it, as you say, leaving behind something that if it just sat there, it would not be a problem. But it would, and again, it's sort of like a metaphorical bomb in a sense. They left it there for that day when they might decide now is the day we want to bring everything down, and they could essentially with a keystroke or with a mouse click turn that on, cause it to do whatever damage it's going to do, and then cause that problem.
Yeah, absolutely, Dave. And you're right in that even in order to have left this malware or bad software, if you will, they would have had to already explore the network in depth, scanned it, probed it, and understand where the connections are, understand how the computer communication infrastructure connects with the underlying physical power grid, and even exploited some vulnerabilities to be able to install some software. Imagine installing anything is a privileged operation in the system. So it's possible that they already were able to find some weakness and then be able to install something there that they could use at a future point in time. But unfortunately, not enough details are available to truly understand what took place.
Yeah. And as far as you know, are we doing the same thing? Is the United States, or should you have every reason to suspect that probably the United States is involved in the same activity as far as other countries are concerned?
Well,
I don't know. I mean,
You don't know. There's stories that when we went into Iraq, we wanted to do. Basically put out the power system through electronic means, but this is not anything that we have seen corroborated. Mm-hmm. But the system was just not that advanced, so we essentially physically had to destroy it, and now we're building it back.
Yeah. But I suppose that it is true that certainly before now, significantly before now, people involved in the government and outside have said, look, we have become so dependent on this system of communications now, the internet, and all of the various information that flows through it. It's something that is a potential vulnerability, and that we ought to be thinking about this and preparing for it and trying to build safety in the system.
I think it's fair to say, David, that clearly there are both defensive cyber operations going on in this country mm-hmm. and offensive cyber operations. Generally speaking, the university's work on the defensive side and all the work on the offensive side is classified. So it would be reasonable to expect offensive work was going on as well, but obviously we can't comment or know about that.
Sure. Oh, one more question, then go to the callers. Is it possible to design a system that can't be hacked? Can you make it so nobody can get in?
That's probably hard to achieve today, and the issue is not whether or not it can be hacked. The issue is whether or not you can limit the consequences after it has been hacked. Mm-hmm. And it is limiting those consequences that's of prime interest right now, given the critical nature of this infrastructure. So we want to make sure that even if someone hacks in, the attack is contained and the damage is limited.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. so in fact, the word that's being used now is resilient. And resilient talks about a grid as well as other cyber infrastructures that although some attacks may be successful, the consequences will be limited. And rather than failing in a brittle way, rather than an all-or-nothing Fort Knox, that we can build systems that will tolerate those kinds of attacks. And that's an old idea in fault-tolerant computing, but maybe a new idea in security that can tolerate those attacks and continue to fulfill whatever mission that they have, whatever goals they have. And we believe that's a much more honest and achievable way to go with things.
Well, and this, it makes me think, again, going back to this event that Professor Gross and I, we were talked about a little while ago, and we talked about when it happened, the 6 years ago, where there was – something happened at one place. There was a problem in one place. And if it had simply been limited to that place, you might say, okay, there would have been an outage right around there. But what happened was we got a cascading effect.
Exactly.
Where it was the proverbial line of dominoes, where you had a problem one place and it knocked down the next one and it knocked down the next one and knocked down the next one. And pretty soon we had this huge, very wide outbreak. And so the question was, well, what could have been done to keep it as contained as possible so that you didn't get this far spreading effect?
So this is part of the resilience that is being described, the way Bill put it. But just keep in mind that knocking down of dominoes that takes place at the speed of light, essentially. Mm-hmm. So no human can intervene in those kind of occasions. And that's why the kind of countermeasures we try to put in there is essentially to island that part of the system so it doesn't infect the rest of the system and we keep it very local. But think of it that in terms of hacking into a system is, yes, you get into the bank. It's not clear that you'll immediately know the combination lock for the vault to get to where the goodies are. And there are always people who can uncover loopholes. Our job is to make sure that we have a countermeasure for every one of these loopholes.
All right. Well, let's talk with some callers here. We have several. We'll take them in the order they came in, and we'll start with line one, and that is Champagne. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Recently I heard on the radio mention of a natural phenomenon. It was just a passing mention, so I didn't give any details. But according to what was said, scientists believe that every century or so that the sun goes through some kind of electronic storm and sends out huge waves of magnetic radiation. And they think that when that happens again, that it would cause all of the electrical systems in the world to go down. And I remember reading years ago that military people were worried that there was a kind of bomb that could be set off in the upper atmosphere that would provide a wave of electromagnetic radiation that could cause the electrical systems to go down. And so I'm wondering, is it possible? Well, first of all, is this concept something that you've heard of? And second, if there's reason to believe that such a thing could happen, is there a way to design the electrical system to be resilient against it? Because having all the electricity go down would be kind of totally catastrophic.
Well, yes, we've heard about it, and we do have incidents. One was in Minnesota, which has happened some time ago. One was in Quebec. But they have to be local. We cannot do it globally to affect all the electricity around the world. And there is some research going on. It's not a very well understood field yet. However, companies have been looking into it, and scientists are working on it. We don't have yet any hard results, but it's a very good question, and we are aware of it.
Thank you.
All right. I don't know anything that you guys would like to add? All right, very good. We'll go to line two then. Urbana, hello.
Hi, how are
yes?
you? It seems odd that that power grids and stuff are connected to the Internet. I mean, I know this probably evolved because of cost, but it seems to me like a few years back when Estonia supposedly wanted to, messing with the Russian government, they supposedly had a cyber attack. As usual, I noticed how you people, and I don't mean to use that as a negative term, how in this field they always say, it's not corroborated, or but it's suspected, and things like that. And the Wall Street Journal, yesterday, I think you talked about that, had the idea that Chinese hackers were trying to break into American companies and steal their technology and whatever, understand all the secrets of their trades and stuff like that. And it seems interesting that I could see that as a business, because I use the Internet a lot. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at the Internet right now. And I noticed that I'm just curious as to why power grids, infrastructure, stuff like that would be on the Internet or accessible through the Internet, where you could, like, shut down power stations or go into maybe even nuclear reactors and all this kind of stuff. And is that valid or is that true?
So let me comment on that. Mm-hmm. And I was the one that talked about the two interrelated networks. And I think it's important to distinguish Internet as a technology, TCP/IP, Ethernet, perhaps even wireless routers, these kind of things, and Internet with a capital I, which is the Internet that we all use to look at the web and presumably you're looking at right now. In general, the intent now is that while Internet technologies are being used and are increasingly being used in control of the power grid, the intent is to keep both logically and physically that Internet with a lowercase I separated from the Internet that's the World Wide Web and the capital I. So you do bring up a very good point, and I appreciate you clarifying it, that that one needs to keep the control networks, the so-called SCADA networks and other networks that provide the control from the grid, separate from the packet flow and the everyday use of the Internet. Now, having said that, there are many ways, many of them accidental, by which the Internet or the Internet technologies that that help in controlling the grid might be accidentally connected. There might be a dial-up modem in which a password was left off. There might be a port in a firewall that was opened up for certain diagnostic reasons and left open. There might be a flaw in the firewall software that uses to isolate or provide the firewall between those two internets that could be exploited that would allow someone to jump across the boundary. So definitely the intent is to keep those things separate. Definitely the smart grid of the future will look at many Internet technologies and how they can be used in the grid in very beneficial ways. But there always is this risk of the crossing over, as you say. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very good point you bring up.
Yeah, well, I want to also mention one thing. I'll get off and let somebody else talk. But I noticed that about 2 years ago, I think it was the Journal or the New York Times, had a thing about a hacker in Russia who had broken all these access codes into banks and stolen $100 million. And supposedly about a year or so, they finally found this guy, you know, in his little apartment in Moscow. And they couldn't really prove anything because he was so sophisticated. But there's a lot of very smart people out there that all they do all day is go after this stuff. I think they do it maybe as a game. But how can you design, as David asked earlier, the Internet to where this sort of ability to hide yourself is negated? Could you talk about that? Thank you. I'll hang up. Bye.
Thanks for that question. So let me comment on that. Yes. Sophisticated adversaries that are focused, targeted, and resourceful are a very big concern for protecting any infrastructure, be it the power grid or the Internet. And it's a constant challenge to figure out how to first make sure that that the consequences of attacks are limited, as I mentioned earlier, but then how to trace them, how to gather sufficient digital evidence, and how to work with law enforcement personnel to go and find these individuals and take them in some court of law and persecute them for the crimes that they have committed. It's a very hard problem, but there is increasing resources being put by our government and other nations to try and figure it out. The Department of Homeland Security, for example, is conducting cyber exercises where they involve a range of entities, including law enforcement, to do exercises for such scenarios. And then we also have building up a number of cases like the one you mentioned where people get the ability to try and explore it and collaborate together to try and figure it out. But yes, it's a hard problem and one that keeps many people up at night to try and figure it out.
Yeah, and then all it takes really to knock everything out is a thunderstorm. And then we're all in trouble.
Maybe, David, I'll just add a couple more comments on that. I think that the caller also made the very good point that although sometimes used when we have nothing better, so-called security by obscurity, or keeping the details hidden about how something operates, is not a very good defense because people are resourceful. People will find out details. And so security as it's practiced today and security that we're working on as researchers really is about how to, with the minimal secrets necessary, maybe just a few private keys, how can we provide security even when the design is very well known? And then another point that the caller made that I think is very important is he mentioned what's called traceback and how when an attack goes on, can we know where that attack's coming from? And and in fact, some people might even say attack back to those kind of attacks. That is very controversial. There are technologies being developed to do that today. But there, of course, is a balance of ability that we can get by this knowledge of managing identities and requiring identities on the net and the issues with regard to privacy. And of course, privacy is an important concern as one uses the net. And taking away that privacy for the benefit of this other activity has its own risks. Yeah.
So I should add, because we're talking about billions of dollars of assets that we're protecting with this cyber infrastructure that we talked about. The government has put in standards in terms of cyber security, which each one of the utilities has now to adhere to, and we are really very, very strict in terms of compliance. And also there's a lot of dedicated networks. We don't only use the internet with a lower eye, but we have dedicated networks purely for the communication which is used by the utility companies. So we have multi-layer. Notwithstanding that, there's still a lot of work to be done, but some of the loopholes have already been closed.
Yeah. Our guests, let me quickly introduce again, and then we have some other callers I want to get to. Our guests here this morning include George Gross. He's the last fellow you heard. He's professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and also is professor in the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. He's been with us before here on the program to talk about things like utility regulation and also the robustness of the distribution system that we have here in this country. And then we have two guests also, both of them involved with the Information Trust Institute. It's here at the University of Illinois. William Sanders, he's the director. He's also professor of engineering. And Himanshu Khurana, he is the principal research scientist. He is also research assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science. And also both of them are involved in a multi-campus kind of organization looking at some of these same issues. It's called the Trustworthy Cyber Infrastructure for the Power Grid Project. Professor Sanders is the director and Professor Khurana is the principal research scientist. And we're talking about cybersecurity and the electricity grid. And questions are welcome. We have a number of other people here who are ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And the next caller is in Champaign and line 3. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Yes.
Good morning. I'm very appreciative of this topic. I don't think we appreciate sometimes how important it is that just we flip a switch and the power is always on. It underpins so much of our modern life, and we need to figure out whether that's sustainable and what we need to do to sustain it. I just wanted to start with like a very quick overall factual question. What's the overall amount of money that we're looking at to upgrade the grid to both, you know, incorporate these cybersecurity aspects and also to handle new sources of renewable energy that have kind of a variable current?
So the estimates range anywhere from $200 billion to a couple of trillion dollars. And we don't know. We know that we have essentially a pretty old transmission grid. By the time we'll be done, it will be an expensive proposition. However, we believe that in terms of the improvements that we will get out of this is going to pay for itself quite quickly. We will have efficiency improvements. We will have situational awareness. We are going to be operating a system which is going to be much cleaner. And we are going to have a customer who's going to be empowered in terms of how he uses clean electricity very efficiently. So we will get that paid back, but it's big dollars. So we're in the ballpark now in terms of the kind of dollars you see coming out of Washington. People don't talk very much below a few hundred billion dollars or trillions.
Okay, all right. It surprises me. We don't even have it pinned down to an order of magnitude at this point. But, you know, whatever it costs is what we need to spend. And so I wanted to move towards the nuts and bolts of implementing it in terms of the utilities' incentives to improve the power grid. And I wanted to ask you just because utilities, I've been trying to think about the economics of this, and it's a very, very complex phenomenon, and there's a lot of forces that are influencing the utilities' perspective on this. One is that they're natural monopolies, which, you know, need to be regulated by the state in order to function well. And two, that they're also purveyors of electricity on a quantity basis. You know, their incentive is to pump as much electricity into your house as they can, because that's how they make their money. And Amory Lovins, when he was here on campus a few weeks ago, talked about decoupling the commodity basis of electricity provision from the utility's business model, so that, you know, their incentive will be to minimize the amount of electricity that they're delivering, and what they'll be selling will be energy efficiency. And so I wanted to ask you about, you know, the utility's incentives on putting these in power grid improvements in place, maybe through this frame. Should we consider this as to be like a public sector investment, like roads and bridges, to which, you know, we wouldn't ask the car companies or the oil companies to contribute to? Or should we think about it as a private sector investment, like, you know, fiber optic cable runs? We wouldn't necessarily think that the government needed to help AT&T out with laying that fiber optic cable. Or is it going to be something in between?
Well, you're very good at basically pointing your finger at this problem, because it is there is a public good aspect to it. Reliability of the power system is a public good. Everybody benefits from it. Okay, the issue is who wants to pay for it. And I think it's probably going to be the mixture that you talked about. There's some money in the stimulus now, something like $4.5 billion for the so-called smart grid concept to try to make that reality. The issue is that we have to do this nationwide, and we have to have standards, and we have to have guidelines. And we have to be able to interoperate this across the countries. So it's a very big, daunting challenge. And at best, at this point, we can get some demonstration projects going. But to do it over the nationwide system, it's going to take some time, and it's going to take a lot of money. And it's going to be basically the combined investment, both from government and also from the private entities. I just want to correct an impression. In terms of the utility concept, today what you call utility here in Illinois would be Illinois Power, which is your distribution company. The generation has already been basically laid aside as a for-profit corporation. They sell their energy output from the plants in the electricity markets. Transmission that's regulated at the federal level. So we have a very complex system over here, which crosses the boundary lines geographically of states, but it's also regulated at the federal level and in some cases even at city levels.
All right. That's very interesting, because I still have the image in my mind of utilities as this vertical monopolies that control everything from the generation of the power at the coal plant through the transmission lines to the last mile infrastructure into the house itself.
No, that's no longer existent, particularly not in Illinois. We have gotten rid of that structure.
And there are
makes it even more complex. Okay, I'll let go and let some of the people talk. But this has been a fascinating conversation.
All right, well, thank you. Just to ask one further very quick question, then we'll get back to some other callers. Assuming that the money was not a problem, then we had the money. How long would it take to construct this new and improved grid that we're talking about? a decade, maybe?
In a decade, I think we would have most of it done.
Yeah. I think it's important to note that we don't know how to construct all of it today. Hmm. That there are parts that we can and should construct today, but we have to do that in concert with research and development work, with standards work, with other works now on the technical side to ensure that that new grid that we do put in is less of a security risk rather than more of a security risk. So this doesn't mean we shouldn't go forward, but it does mean that that it's okay that it's going to take a little while because there's questions to be answered that we can answer as we're doing it.
I would say there are two dimensions of this construction that we're talking about. One is developing the right technology and deploying it that is able to connect the computer and communication infrastructure, the smarts, if you will, in a better way with the electrical grid. Mm-hmm. And the second is to then use it to enable new kinds of applications, new efficiency and cleanness that we all desire, such as renewable integration that our caller earlier asked about. So there are a sufficient number of low-hanging fruit in both of these dimensions that we can go after. And that's what people are doing. For example, demand response where you can control thermostats in a more collective way, program them and network them, is a nice application that people are already working on. Some of the more future ones are things like plug-in hybrid electric vehicles that are connected to the grid in some selective way. That may take a little bit longer. But there are enough low-hanging fruit and ideas in place to get this going and to start building the capabilities and also using them to improve efficiency and provide clean
So one of the things we'll have to do is, for example, to get in the smart devices into the system. And we're talking about the refrigerator, which can basically look at the signal of how much does it cost to run the motor at this point and to decide, no, I'm not going to run it now because it's too expensive. I'm going to lay off a cycle and I'm going to run it later. So we're not going to replace the existing stock of appliances with smart refrigerators right away. So when we say a decade, I think we can think about the infrastructure. But both of my colleagues are absolutely right that there's a lot of technology aspects that we know how to solve, but they're not necessarily meant on a nationwide application. Consequently, the type of research which is going on now is very critical to doing it correctly.
And let me just make one comment very quickly, which I think is important, is that this evolution, if you will, and it's more of an evolution than something we're going to do one day, really requires this new combined expertise I talked about, the computer scientists and engineers, the power engineers and the economists. And just to correct one aspect of fact of what we're talking about, it's not just Himanshu and myself that are key people in this TSIP center that's working on this. George Gross is also one of the principal researchers there. And in fact, it's that combination of power people, economists and computer scientists and engineers. So we count George as one of us now.
We've got about 10 minutes left here. And our guests are William Sanders. He's professor of engineering here at the U of I. He's director of the Information Trust Institute. Himanshu Khurana is a research assistant professor in computer science and is also a part of the Information Trust Institute. George Gross is professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and also is in the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And we have several callers here. We'll try to get him in the time that remains. Next up is a caller in Belgium. Line one, hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Now, I must preface this statement that I'm not near as educated or as intelligent as either your guest or your other listeners. But it just seems to me, sirs, that a great number of us have natural gas piped into our homes already. And it seems to me that we can solve this huge problem by generating our electricity on site by using fuel cell situations or solar panels. And the huge bulk of energy that is used by individuals in homes and stuff. We could solve a great deal of this problem just by going to a more localized, very localized energy grid. Use it a 10-volt system, and you can run an entire house with 10 volts. No problem. Understand when it comes to factories and universities and large power consumers, there's another situation there. But why don't we go back to the beginning and think more, let's keep it local. Let's don't get worried about a grid.
So, you know, you outlined one possible way of doing it. And I'm not saying that it cannot be done. And it may not be efficient in certain cases, particularly if you're a very remote entity, 15 or 20 miles from the nearest substation or the transmission line, you may be able to do that. The reason we built the huge grid that connects the systems, that we wanted to take advantage of economies of scale. The second issue is that what happens when that generator you have that uses natural gas is going to stop generating? Are you going to buy a second one to have a backup? You don't have the reliability. And particularly if you have some medical devices, lung machine system, which is dependent on electricity, you cannot afford to have that kind of interruption. So your solution is certainly a possibility, but we cannot base the entire system on that.
Well, I was meaning more in a form of a fuel cell situation, which has a great deal more efficiencies than just generating it by internal combustion.
Well, I think fuel cells will have their applications, and this could be one of them. At this stage, they're not at the sufficiently mature development, and the pricing is not very good that you would want to base yourself on that. But we are advocating essentially all of these options, and in fact, we're building the system to be sufficiently reliable, resilient, and robust to be able to incorporate all of these local options. We're not excluding them, but we have to understand that even though we have airplanes and buses and so forth today, we're still dependent on the railroad system of moving the merchandise from point A to point B in this country. So we need that that backbone structure which the transmission grid provides us.
Just have a couple minutes left. Again, I want to thank the caller and get at least one more caller. This would be somebody in Champaign, and it's line number two. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was going to bring up a similar point that the previous caller brought up, which was about more localized production of energy, not at the level I think he was talking about, the homeowner or the individual user level, but at the community level, that sort of thing, that possibility. The other thing that I wondered if this might play into that, there's been some publicity recently about cold fusion, although they're not calling it cold fusion now. It's some kind of a molecular-level interaction or atomic-level interaction that can produce electricity. I wanted to know, do you think that can play any role, number one? And number two, is the development of that being held back because it's being developed by a private company rather than a government entity? What's the future of that process? And I'll hang up and listen.
So I'll comment briefly on the first part of your question. I'll try to throw the second part to George if he's willing to comment. In the first part, I think what you and the previous caller point out is that the future smart grid that we're all working to design will have as its cornerstone diversity in what's local and what's more far-reaching generation, diversity in the type of power generation. And it's through that diversity, not inherently, but that diversity connected together by the grid that George talked about so well, that is going to give us the high availability and is going to give us the efficiency we need. Now, as for the specific technology you commented on, I'm not an expert on, so I can't comment.
In fact, that's a very, very expensive technology, and I hope that we continue researching it because there's no magic bullet that we can say that we'll be able to meet our country's energy needs in the future. We will still depend on coal because we get 50% of electricity based on coal. So to the extent that we can offload that coal use and clean up the environment, it's very important that we focus on it, but it's not going to be something near term.
Wait, we've got a couple minutes left. I realize this is certainly one thing I would say is we have lots of opportunities for more conversations talking about further about all these things. But I guess I find myself wondering, and as we talk about the way that we use energy, the way that we generate energy, whether at least in the near term, and I'm talking here about, I don't know, 15, 20 years, whether what we're going to be doing is refining what we're already doing now, Or is it likely that something remarkable, some new remarkable thing is going to come along and going to solve all of our problems?
So one of the things which we're doing, which is something different than we ever did before, we're really going to bring the consumer into the picture, where the consumer will be able to decide when he uses electricity or energy and how he uses that electricity. We're installing this new automated meters throughout this service territory, but throughout the nation, which is going to be able to give the consumer real-time information, how much does electricity cost now? And you can become a very intelligent user in terms of not using it now when it's $2 or $3 a kilowatt hour, but waiting till after 10 o'clock at night when you can get it for 2 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour. Mm-hmm. So we bring in the demand side. By bringing in the demand side, we are going to be lowering the demand. Consequently, we may not need to build as many plants as we would have had to build otherwise. We are helping the supply side by building the smart grid and being able to integrate all the renewable resources. We are going to have cleaner resources, so we're bringing in sustainability. So we're trying to address the issue in all sides. It's going to take time, and it's going to take lots of money, but we're on it. And as my colleagues have been emphasizing, given the type of technology we use, we have to make sure that the smart grid is not only smart, it's actually wise and it's secure.
Yeah. Anything you would want to?
No, I think, you know, the challenge about the predicting the future is these miraculous changes you mentioned. I mean, of course they are hard to predict. I think the key really is a very different kind of grid infrastructure. And George said it well, so I don't need to repeat that. But doing that in a way that preserves the security and preserves the availability of the system.
Well, at that, and again, with the acknowledgement that we have a lot of the things I'm sure we could talk about in the future, for right now, we'll have to stop with our thanks to William Sanders. He's professor of engineering here at U of I, director of the Information Trust Institute, and is also the project director of the Trustworthy Cyber Infrastructure for the Power Grid Project. Himanshu Khurana is also part of the Information Trust Institute, and TCIP, he's the principal research scientist for that. He is research assistant professor in computer science here at the U of I, and also George Gross, he's a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and also is affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David.
This program, Focus 580, is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, now with 4 area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com. WYLL, this radio station, is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Later today, as part of the afternoon magazine, Celeste Quinn talks with Mark Sloan. He's a pediatrician who, since 1977, has attended nearly 3,000 births. He's the author of the book Birthday, A Pediatrician Explores the Science, the History, and the Wonder of Childbirth. Former patients now actually bring their children to see him. He calls himself a pediatric grandfather, and he's taken some time to think about his experiences, all involving birth, and he'll talk about that with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine today. Coming up in the next hour of this show, we'll be talking about the final report of the Illinois Reform Commission. We'll have 2 members of the commission on to talk about political reform here in the state of Illinois. First, though, we'll take a break for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets at mid-session. Wheat futures have turned lower at the Chicago Board of Trade on technical selling after prices climbed to over $5.90 a bushel. Forecasts for drier weather next week, which could speed up the pace of planting the spring wheat crop, also is weighing on the market this morning. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. in Kansas City, May wheat at 640 up 6, July 638 and a quarter up 3 quarters. At the Board of Trade, May 380 and 3 quarters down 1 and 3 quarters. July 388 and 3 quarters down 4. September 615 and 3 quarters down 3 and 3 quarters. May corn 421 up 1 and a half. July 428 and a half up 1. December 449 and a quarter up 1 and a quarter. March of 2010 459 and 3 quarters.